2. Intergalactic Eyes. Danny Quee looked out from the western Terra Tower of X-Gal 4, a solitary outpost on the outer rim planet of Belkaden in the Dalanbian sector. Danny came here often at this time of day, late afternoon, to watch the Belkaden sunset filtering through the 30-meter Dalarala trees. Of late, those sunsets had been more spectacular for some reason, with tinges of orange and green edging the typical pinks and crimsons. She had been on Belkaden for 3 years, an original member of X-Gal 4, and traced her roots to the always underfunded X-Gal Society back another 3 years before that, to when she was only 15. Her homeworld, a core planet, was badly overcrowded, and for independent Danny, even trips to other nearby worlds didn't seem to alleviate the feeling of being squeezed by too many people. She wasn't a fan of the government, be it the Empire or the New Republic. She wasn't a fan of anything bureaucratic. In fact, she considered the ordering of the galaxy a terrible thing, robbing people of excitement and adventures, burying cultures beneath the blanket of common civilization. Thus the notion that there might be life beyond the galaxy, the thought of something undiscovered, excited the young woman. Or once had. Now standing there, staring at the same landscape of towering trees and unbroken green canopy, the young woman wondered again if she had chosen her life's path correctly. At 21, she was one of the youngest members of the 15 stationed on X-Gal 4, and one of only 4 women. She had developed into a very attractive young woman, small of frame, with long curly blonde hair and green eyes that always seemed to be asking questions of everything they surveyed, and of late it seemed as if she had spent more time resisting the advances of several young men than in staring out at the galactic rim. In truth, Danny didn't blame the young men, though. They had all come out here full of hope and adventure, pioneers on the edge of the galaxy. In short order, they had established a base, a walled fort, actually, to hold out the savage wildlife of Belkaden, and had set up their listening and looking equipment, great dishes and telescopes, including orbiting scopes. That first year had been full of dreams and hard work and danger. 2 of the original members had been seriously wounded when a red-crested cougar had leapt over the wall from a nearby tree. And so the work had continued, clearing the trees back 30 meters, further securing the outpost. All that work was done now, with X-Gal 4 secured and self-contained, with an abundant clear water well right below them and multiple gardens, a smoothly functioning scientific outpost. Danny missed the old days. Even the faces of those around her had become stale, though half the members were not original colonists, but had rotated in from other X-Gal satellite stations or from the independent X-Gal Society's home base. The bottom rim of the sun dipped below the distant horizon, and the orange and green tints spread wide from north to south. Somewhere unseen in the jungle, a red-crested cougar gave a long and low growl, heralding the onset of twilight. Danny took it all in and tried to dream, but given the reality of her current tedium, the endless listening for signals that never came, the endless staring at the same intergalactic haze, she wasn't quite sure of what she should dream about. Behind her, from one of the windows of the station's center structure, Yeoman Carr watched the young woman's every move. He was new to the station, the most recent to join the crew, and it hadn't taken him long to recognize that many of the others looked up to Danny Quee, and that many of the men were obviously attracted to her. Yeoman Carr didn't understand that sentiment at all. He found Danny, as he did all humans, quite repulsive. For while Yeoman Carr's people, the Yuuzhan Vong, resembled humans in form, though they were on average a dozen or so centimeters taller and quite a bit heavier, and had less hair on their heads, both face and scalp, their ways were hardly similar. Even if Yeoman Carr might admit that Danny was somewhat attractive physically, though how could she be, with not a single scar or tattoo to mark her rise toward godhood, those tenet differences, attitude differences, made him consider any union with her with disgust. He was Yuuzhan Vong, not human, and a Yuuzhan Vong warrior. How ironic, then, that the pitiful humans thought him one of them. Despite his revulsion, he did watch Danny, and often, for she above all others was the leader of this democratic group. According to the others, she had been the one to kill the cougar that had slipped into the compound that first year. She had been the one to take the creaking old space caster shuttle into orbit to repair the damaged orbiting telescope only a couple of months earlier, and she had been the one to figure out how that scope might be repaired in the first place. They all looked up to her. She was the one Yeoman Carr could not ignore. "Early again?" came a voice behind Yeoman Carr. He turned to regard the speaker, though he knew from the voice, particularly the teasing tone, that it was Benson Tomry. "Or is it that you're still here from last night?" Tomry went on, and he gave a chuckle. Yeoman Carr smiled, but did not reply. No answer was needed, he understood, for these people often wasted words merely to hear the sound of their own voice. Besides, there was more truth to the words than Benson Tomry could ever guess. Yeoman Carr had not been in here straight through since his shift the previous night, but he had been present more often than not. The others of the station thought it was simply newbie excitement, the feeling they had all shared when they had first arrived that the elusive extragalactic signal could happen at any time. In their eyes, Yeoman Carr had taken that excitement to the extreme, perhaps, but he had done nothing, he was confident, to arouse any real suspicion. "He'll get bored with it soon enough," Garth Bryce said. Another of the night shift controllers, sitting up on the wide room's higher level, where the comfortable chairs, the gaming table, and the food could be found. The room was elliptical, with a wide view screen on the front wall, 7 control pods in a 3-1-3 pattern before it, and the raised galley area taking up the rear quarter. Yeoman Carr forced another smile at the remark and made his way down toward the front of the room, to his usual position at pod 3, the left-hand one of the first row. He heard Garth and Benson whispering some remarks about him from above, but he ignored them, taking the attack on his pride, normally a call for a death duel, in stride with the knowledge that soon enough they would know better. Danny Quee entered next, moving down to pod 4, the central pod, the one whose viewing scan overlapped the quadrant scanned by all 6 of the others. Then came the last member of the night shift, Tiubo Duel, the Twi'lek woman, the only non-human, as far as the others knew, among the 15 at the station. Tiubo gave Yeoman Carr a sly look, almost a wink, and stretched languidly and shifted her leku, the twin tentacles that grew out of the back of a Twi'lek's head. She had made no secret of her interest in the newcomer, which amused Yeoman Carr greatly, for he was coming to understand these people and their constant insecurities. Normally a Twi'lek woman, with her exotic leku and greenish skin and typically scarce clothing, would be the center of male attention anywhere outside her home planet of Ryloth, and Twi'lek women were known to enjoy such attention greatly. But Tiubo had found more than her match in Danny. Still looking at Yeoman Carr, the Twi'lek held up a small vial and gave it a shake. Rill, Yeoman Carr knew, a recreational intoxicant that several of the compound members used to alleviate the boredom. He noted, too, that Danny crinkled her nose in disgust at the sight and even shook her head in disapproval. For a long while, Danny had forbidden Tiubo from bringing the stuff anywhere near the control room, but even the resolute Danny had relented, though her motion to Tiubo made it clear that she wanted the intoxicant off the main floor. Both Benson and Garth were more than happy with that request. Tiubo was running low of the rill now and had become stingy about handing any out. They weren't expecting any cargo shuttles for several months, and despite the Twi'lek's best efforts, there was no guarantee that any of the illicit drug would even make it aboard the next shuttle. They settled in then to their usual positions. After a quick check of all systems from the central pod, and setting the forward screen to cycle through the smaller viewers of each individual pod, Danny joined the others, who were done with the rill and were all laughing in the galley area. On her suggestion, they began a 4-way game of Dejeric, a board game where holographic monsters of varying strength traveled specified paths along the rows of squares, vying for tactical advantages against their opponents. At his post, Yeoman Carr, as he did every night and most days, when he could inconspicuously hang out about the pod, dialed down the volume so that only he would hear any telltale signals, and covertly locked his dish on Sector L-30, the location he knew to be the entry point, Vector Prime. "You want to play?" came Benson Tomry's call an hour later, his tone making it clear to Yeoman Carr that Tomry was not faring well in the strategic battle. A part of Yeoman Carr wanted to go up there and engage in the game, particularly waging against Danny, who was a strong strategist. Such competitions were good. They kept the warrior mind sharp and focused. "No," he answered, as he had for every night in the last few weeks. "Work to do." "Work?" Benson Tomry scoffed. "Like the greatest scientific discovery of the last millennium will happen at any second to your waiting eyes." "If you feel truth to that, on the next shuttle you should go?" Yeoman Carr politely returned, and he saw by their curious expressions that he had mixed up his sentence structure again. He made a mental note to review with his teasel worms later on. "Newbie," Benson muttered sarcastically under his breath. "He's got a point," Danny said, and Benson threw up his hands and turned away from the table. "Are you sure?" Danny asked Yeoman Carr. "I enjoy this," he replied haltingly, paying careful attention to every word, then settling comfortably into the pod's chair. Danny didn't argue. In fact, Yeoman Carr understood that she respected his dedication, that she wished some of the others would follow his example. And so it went as the night lengthened. Benson Tomry was soon snoring contentedly, while Tiubo and Garth Bryce argued and tittered about everything and nothing at all, and Danny continued to play degeric, but against three computer opponents. Then it happened. Yeoman Carr caught the slight blip on the very edge of the pod's view screen out of the corner of his eye. He froze, staring intently, and dialed up the volume just a bit. It came again, accompanied by the rhythmic signal that could only emanate from a ship. Yeoman Carr could hardly find his breath after all the years of preparation. The Yuuzhan Vong warrior shook such distracting thoughts from his head. He waited a moment longer to confirm the positioning, Vector Prime, the predetermined entry point into the galaxy. Then he quickly shifted his dish all the way over to Sector L-1. That would buy him a couple of hours on this screen. He looked up at the main viewer, repeating the image of the central pod, and breathed a sigh of relief to see that it had already cycled past Pod 3 and wouldn't be back for at least an hour. And even then, it would not overlap past L-25, and the signal would be long past that point. With the dish angle changed, Yeoman Carr dialed his volume back up to normal, then stood up and stretched, his movement attracting Danny's attention. "Walkeye," he started to explain and realized that he was confusing the sentence structure once more. "I need to take a walk," he corrected. The woman nodded. "It's quiet enough," she replied. "You can knock off for the rest of the shift if you want." "No," he answered. "I need just only to stretch out a bit." Danny nodded and went back to her game, and Yeoman Carr walked out of the room. As soon as the control room's door was closed behind him, he removed his hard boots and broke into a dead run. He had to pause for a long while he got into his private quarters, forcing himself to steady his breathing. It would not do for the executor to see him so obviously rattled. Nor would it do for the executor to see him in this horrid human disguise, he reminded himself. Never mind that humans did not typically appropriately paint their skins or mutilate any part of their bodies to show their worship to a worthy pantheon. Human eyes did not droop with the appealing bluish sacks beneath them, as did Yuuzhan Vong eyes, and the human forehead was flat, not enticingly sloped as were those of the Yuuzhan Vong. No, even after these months as an advance agent of the Praetorite Vong, Yeoman Carr could hardly stand the sight of the infidels. He stripped off his clothing and moved to the full-length mirror at the side of his room. He liked to watch this, to use the visual stimulation to heighten the sensation of exquisite agony. He moved his hand up beside his nose, to the little crease beside his nostril, his fingers working at the obscure seam at the side of his left nostril, the contact point for the Ooglith masker. Sensitive to his touch and well-trained, the creature immediately responded. And Yomankar clenched his teeth and fought hard to steady his trembling as the thousands of tiny grappling tendrils pulled free of his pores, the Ooglith masker rolling back over his nose and separating across his cheeks. The seam widened down his chin and neck and the front of his torso, his fake skin peeling back, rolling down until he merely stepped out of it. The Ooglith masker shuffled across the floor toward the dark closet, making slurping, sucking sounds as it moved, and Yomankar stood at the mirror, regarding his true form admiringly, his taut, strong muscles, his tattoo pattern, nearly complete upon his body, a sign of high rank in the warrior class, and mostly his intentional disfigurements, the oft-broken nose, the extended tear to his lip, the split eyelid. And now, showing his ornamental disfigurements and tattoos, he was ready to address the executor on this most important matter. He moved to the side of the room, to his locker, and he was trembling so badly that he could hardly work the combination. He finally did manage to open it, though, and as the top rolled back, the platform inside raised up, showing a brown cloth covering a pair of ball-like lumps. Gently, Yomankar removed the cloth and considered the lumps, his villips. He almost went to the one on the left, the one joined with Prefect Dagara's villip, but he knew the protocol and wouldn't dare disobey. So he went to the one on the right and gently stroked its ridged top until the single break in the membranous tissue, a hole that resembled an eye socket, puckered to life. Yomankar continued to stroke the creature to awaken the consciousness joined villip more than halfway across the galaxy. He felt the pull of that creature a moment later and knew the sensation to mean that the executor had heard his call and was likewise awakening his own villip. Yomankar moved his hand back fast as that central hole puckered and then opened wide and then rolled back over itself, the villip inverting to assume the appearance of the head of the executor. Yomankar bowed respectfully. "It is time," he said, glad to be using his native language once more. "You have silenced the station?" the executor asked. "I go now," Yomankar explained. "Then go," the executor said, and with typical discipline, not even inquiring about the details of the incoming signal, he broke communication. In response, Yomankar's villip rolled back in on itself to once again appear as a nondescript, ridged, membranous ball. Again, the warrior resisted the urge to utilize the other villip, reminding himself that he had to move fast, that the executor would not tolerate any failure from him at this critical juncture. He rushed across the room, back to his closet, and took out a small coffer. He kissed it twice and muttered a swift prayer before opening it. Inside sat a small statue of a creature, the most beautiful creature of all to Yomankar and to all the warriors of the Yuuzhan Vong. Its mass resembled a brain, with a single huge eye and a puckered maw. Many tentacles extended from that bulk, some thick and short, others fine and long. This was Yun Yamka, the Slayer, the Yuuzhan Vong god of war. Yomankar prayed again, the entire litany of Yun Yamka, then kissed the statue gently and replaced the coffer in his closet. He wore only a skin loincloth, as it had been in the purer days of his warrior people's dawn, showing all of his remarkable tattoos and his rippling muscles, and he carried only his kalfi, a crude but ultimately effective large double-edged knife, again a ceremonial throwback to the early days of the warrior Yuuzhan Vong. Yomankar thought all ceremony appropriate for this particular mission, the linking salvo between the advance force and the actual invasion. He poked his head out into the hall, then moved through the complex, his bare feet making not a whisper of sound. He knew that getting out of the place without his human disguise might be difficult, but realized also that if he was discovered without the masker, no one would recognize him as their associate. Besides, he figured, if he was discovered, that would only be an excuse to kill someone, an appropriate sacrifice to Yun Yamka on this momentous night. The night was chill, but that only invigorated Yomankar. His blood pumped furiously from the excitement, from the danger of this mission, to the understanding that the great doctrine was at last underway. He ran to the wall and sprinted up a ladder, scrambling over the top and dropping, with hardly a thought, to the cleared ground outside. The distant roar of a red-crested cougar gave him no pause. He was in that creature's element now, but he too was a hunter. Perhaps one of those 140-kilogram animals with 10-centimeter fangs, huge claws, and a tail that ended in a lump of bone as solid as any crafted cudgel would provide him good sport this night. And Yomankar was ready for such a challenge. His blood pounding, his strong heart racing, a terrific fight would be a wonderful release. But not now, he reminded himself, for he was indeed drifting toward the thick jungle canopy in anticipation of meeting a red-crested cougar. He straightened his line and ran flat out to the tall girder work tower, the only structure outside the compound. He considered the thick cable that crawled out from the compound to the base of the metalwork and almost started for it with his Kaufi. Too easy to repair, he realized, and his gaze drifted up, up. Fortunately, the gridwork pattern of the girders was not wide-spaced, so up Yomankar went, hand over hand, his strong-toned muscles working furiously, propelling him fast to the top of the 100-meter tower. He didn't look down, was not afraid, was never afraid, and focused solely on the junction box and the cable. Chill winds buffeted him, giving him an idea, so he went to work on the connection between cable and box gently, easing out one rivet, turning open one screw. The others, if they ever managed to get this far along in their repairs, would think this damage to be the result of the constant wind and the often harsh Belkaden weather. Secured that the connection was broken, Yomankar started down the tall tower, again working fast, reminding himself that the incoming signal was likely nearing L-10, and that he had a long way yet to go. He dropped the last few meters, landing in a roll and coming up right beside the cable. This time he couldn't resist. He knew that these were just communication wires and nothing carrying substantial power. He brought the cable to his mouth and chewed it viciously, taking perverted pleasure in the tingle of pain as he got through the insulation and sparks erupted all about his mouth and face. Let them find this break and repair it, he thought, and then return inside to learn that the system still would not function. Mouth, cheeks, and chin bloody, his nose, already permanently misshapen and flattened to one side, torn along both nostrils, the warrior started back for the compound, but he stopped fast, noting a movement along the ground not far away. He hustled over and fell to his knees, and then smiled widely as he held up a reddish-brown beetle with hooked mandibles and a single protruding tubular tongue. "My pet," he whispered, for he had not seen any of the beetles since coming to Belkaden, since bringing them to Belkaden, and he was glad to learn that they had already traveled this far across the planet's surface. Danny Quee would soon learn the reason that her precious sunsets were becoming somewhat tinted. Yomankar set the Dweebit down again, and reminding himself of the dangers of delay, sprinted back for the compound, catching the top of the 3-meter wall in one great leap, then running on back into the main structure, padding quietly along darkened, silent halls. In his own room, he went to the closet, bidding the Ooglith masker back to him. The pain as the creature enveloped him, thousands of tiny tendrils boring into his skin, was perfectly exquisite, bringing shudder after shudder of edgy pleasure to Yomankar. A quick trip to the mirror showed him that the disguise was complete. Then he took out another small coffer and carefully removed the top. Inside was a single wriggling creature, a small worm. Yomankar eased the coffer up near to his ear and tilted it, and the worm responded, crawling forth and burrowing right into the Yuuzhan Vong's ear cavity. Yomankar put his finger up there a moment later to ensure that the Tizo worm had crawled all the way in, and also to signal the creature to begin its work. He felt the low vibrations a moment later. Tizo worms were decoders, a creature bred by the Yuuzhan Vong alchemists to translate other languages. Despite their diminutive size, they could store enormous amounts of information and could emit that information subliminally. Thus, as Yomankar left his room, he was getting yet another lesson in the language most commonly used in this galaxy. A few minutes later, he was back in the control room to find T. Ubo and a very unsteady Garth huddled about Pod 3, with Danny working to reposition Pod 4 to the same alignment.
Yeoman, Danny called, noting his return. Come here quick. I can't believe you missed this.
Missed? Yeoman Carr echoed.
A signal,
Danny explained breathlessly. Static, Yeoman Carr offered, running to her side. And there it was, on the screen and through the audio lead, the clear signal of something, something very large, crossing through the galactic rim into the galaxy.
Extragalactic, Danny said seriously.
Yeoman Carr bent low over the instruments, studying the data, calculating the vector, though he knew, of course, that Danny's description had been accurate. He looked up at her solemnly and nodded. Benson Tomry burst into the room then, along with several other members of the team, and soon enough, all 15 were present, angling the pod viewers, computer-enhancing the signals, running comparisons of this signal to all the millions of others in their databanks, trying to gain as many perspectives as possible on whatever had just streaked into their galaxy. Then, predictably, the debate began. It never ceased to amaze Yeoman Carr how endlessly these humans could debate and argue about practically anything, an observation that merely reinforced his belief in the strict hierarchical structure of his own society. He would never question a prefect. A prefect would never question a high prefect, as these fools were arguing with Danny now. Never. And that, he believed, was the weakness his masters would come to exploit. At first, the debate centered on the composition of the incoming asteroid. As it was transmitting no apparent technological signals, there was little argument for its being a vessel. An asteroid, then, somehow finding its way through the great emptiness between galaxies, somehow penetrating the turbulence some scientists theorized existed beyond the small band of empty space surrounding the galaxy, and obviously getting some sort of a boost in speed. Perhaps from crossing too near a tremendous gravity field in the process. That belief that this was merely an extragalactic lump of rock, perhaps even a lump of rock from their own galaxy that had somehow escaped and then got pulled back in, did little to temper the excitement, though. Before this moment, no one had ever witnessed evidence of, let alone the actual event of, an extragalactic breach. Many scientists argued that such a breach could not even be accomplished. Certainly several brave explorers and a couple of desperate outlaws being chased by the authorities had gone into the turbulence of the galactic rim over the last few decades, but none had ever been heard from again. Here might be the answer. And the questions. What materials might this asteroid contain? What signs of life? Would this asteroid, once they caught up to it and examined it, provide new answers to the questions of the universe, perhaps even to the creation of the universe? Or would it simply raise many, many more questions, perhaps some that went to the very root of their understanding of physics? And then the debate shifted to a less profound, though certainly no less contested, matter. It started when Benson Tomry remarked that he would put together the announcement to be broadcast back to X-Gal Command. Not yet, another of the scientists strongly argued.
We have to tell them, Benson replied. We have to get some ships out here fast enough to catch the thing for study.
Where's it going? The other man came back sarcastically.
It's in our galaxy now, and we can track it to the other rim if necessary, another added.
We're not an autonomous unit, a woman, Lysira reminded.
Aren't we? Another argued.
But do we really know what we're tracking? Yeoman Carr asked,
and all eyes turned toward him, most expressions incredulous.
Do we?
He asked again, in all seriousness.
Something extragalactic, another answered.
Never did I agree to that, Yeoman Carr said, and again the curious expressions turned his way.
We don't know that, Danny put in, apparently taking Yeoman Carr's side. We've already agreed that it's just as likely an asteroid from our own galaxy that escaped, or nearly escaped, and was pulled back in.
It could indeed be something from our own galaxy, Yeoman Carr went on, smiling inwardly at the irony of that statement, at the secret double meaning of our own galaxy. In fact, I think it very likely that it is just that.
Then what's your point? Benson Tomry asked rather indignantly.
My point? Yeoman Carr echoed, mostly because it bought him the time to figure out the meaning, with help from the Tizo worm, of that curious expression.
My point is that we do not even know if it was ever extragalactic, Yeoman Carr answered.
You saw the vector, Benson argued.
I did indeed, Yeoman Carr said. A vector that could reflect a rebound.
That's absurd, Benson retorted.
How come we didn't track it out there then? Another asked.
We do not know that we didn't, Yeoman Carr said. He held up his hands to deflate any further attacks. All that I am saying is that we should be absolutely certain before alerting the rest of the galaxy.
And any call we make will be public information before it ever gets to Xgal Command, Danny agreed.
Yes, Yeoman Carr said. And then we may discover the signal to be no more than a failure of one of our tracking systems, or a piece of useless space debris bouncing back in from our own galaxy. And how intelligent we shall look in the eyes of the judging Xgal commanders.
This is bigger than us, Benson Tomry replied.
It is, Danny agreed. But we were put out here to function independently.
Maybe Yeoman Carr's right.
If we go prematurely alerting the whole galaxy, we could look like fools.
And any such error, rousing half the fleet, could hurt the funding of Xgal, T. Ubo added with a nod.
Even if we are correct, if this is something that escaped and returned, or even something from another galaxy, or from the supposed emptiness between galaxies, are you ready to announce it?
Yeoman Carr asked Benson directly.
Benson looked at him as if he did not understand.
Do you want a host of New Republic scientists, and perhaps even a couple of Jedi Knights to show up? Yeoman Carr asked sarcastically.
Some of the expressions coming back at him showed that others hardly saw any connection between this and the Jedi, but Yeoman Carr didn't let that slow him.
This is our moment. This is what we have earned from our sacrifice of months, for most of you even years, of our lives, toiling in this wretched place. At the very least, we owe it to ourselves to prevent embarrassment, or to ensure our proper credit if it does show to be extragalactic. To begin the first formal study, to chart where it came from to make sure it's not a rebound, to chart its current path, and to try to gain as many insights as possible.
Way to go, newbie, Garth Bryce remarked with a grin.
The debate ended as abruptly as it had begun. Danny backed Yeoman's argument completely, and even Benson didn't disagree.
Yeoman Carr smiled inwardly once again. If practical arguments didn't work against these often stubborn inferior heretics, then appealing to their overblown sense of pride always did. He looked about at the working scientists, at their excitement and sense of relief and accomplishment.
If only they knew.
More than halfway across the galaxy, Gnome Anor sat quietly in front of his villop, considering the words of his agent, Yeoman Carr.
It had begun.